talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, exploring the life and legacy of one of Ireland's most influential historians, the memoirs of a maverick Republican whose career spanned the course of the 20th century, and to end the show, we'll have some rugby for you with the story of the Limerick Lions. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. We begin tonight's show with one of the first biographies of an Irish historian, Robin Dudley Edwards. The intellectual revolution that spread internationally after World War II in the study of history manifested itself early in Ireland. Two young historians had begun switching direction in 1938, moving from a history brewed of myth and legend into one based on fact and analysis. And one of these historians was Robin Dudley Edwards, later Professor of Modern Irish History at University College Dublin for 35 years. And a new book tells his story. The book is called Telling the Truth is Dangerous: How Robert Dudley Edwards Changed Irish History Forever. It's published in paperback by Tartaruga Books. The author is Nessa McAlane. And Nessa, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Now, first of all, Robert Dudley Edwards was your grandfather. So what was it like approaching the study of this monumental, iconic Irish historian and historical figure as the granddaughter?
It was only when I realised that there were 70 boxes of his archives in the UCD out at Belfield that I thought it was possible. And then, I didn't really worry too much about it because I've been a journalist all my life and had to write some pretty hard stories. And I loved Dudley and got to know him both as a friend and as a grandfather. And I feel that when you're writing about people, if you're writing a book review or if whatever story you're writing, if you can get on that person's wavelength, then you really understand them and can give the best explanation of them. But I wasn't going to pretend that he was a saint, because everyone knew he wasn't a saint, and he was a very analytical person and would have been appalled if I'd just written the story of Saint Dudley.
It's interesting the way you call him Dudley there. I went to UCD to study history in the 1990s, and all the staff there had stories about Dudley. Dudley was this larger-than-life figure who loomed over the combined departments of history, and there were so many anecdotes about him. He was a real figure, but he was also a mythical figure in the landscape.
Yes, I think he partly played on that in a way, because actually at home, the Dudley I knew is quite a reserved and almost shy person. As you would expect, he was someone who was happiest, as he wrote in his diaries, when he was sitting there working on ideas all the time. And so, but he realised that to put over history in its best way and interest students, that if he could bring his personality and his physical presence, because he was 6 foot tall and very distinctive looking with the white hair brushed up and so on, that would really help him. He was the same person when he was at home, but he was much less flamboyant. And in the house, he was one of the quieter ones. He and I would probably have been the quieter ones.
Well, let's talk about his early life and his development and how he ended up in UCD, because he's there for, you know, hearing the gunfire during 1916 to then in the 1930s embarking in this study of history and working with Theo Moody in Trinity and really becoming the two dominant figures in Irish history for, you know, decades afterwards.
Yeah, they both had something in common, which was that they had both seen terrible violence and been very frightened as children that they would be caught up in it. He was nearly enrolled to fight in the Civil War, and that terrified him. And Moody had experiences that were just as shocking. And they didn't really disclose it, because it could have ruined their reputations as historians. In a country where heroes carried guns, you couldn't really be anti-violence. But that was one of they were really studying studying constitutional history and democratic history and encouraging rational debate as an alternative to carrying guns. But they... What they did was that they professionalised history, the study of history, before most of the other subjects were professionalised, so that Ireland could develop its own history. When they worked together in London, they were both studying there for their PhDs, and they realised that the British had no idea of Irish history at all. They didn't even think that it existed, and that basically was what was really worrying Dudley and his friend Theo Moody. And so when they came back from London in the 1930s, they were trying to produce Irish history almost so that Ireland would have an identity. It's only when you have an identity, either as a person or as a country, that you can actually argue that you have rights to this land and this culture and this language. And so they're very intensely worked on that, and they knew that as historians they could see all the signs of war brewing in a calamitous way around the world, and they managed to establish the production of analytical history as opposed to myth-based history just really in 1938-1939 before the Second World War broke out, and that would have held up their plans to professionalise history, as you can imagine.
And they established the Irish Historical Society, the journal Irish Historical Studies, which is still going very strong and is that, you know, preeminent Irish history journal. And very much they were putting in place the institutions and the infrastructure that is still so hugely important in the study of Irish history today.
Oh, absolutely. They're planning the celebrations, I think, for the 90th birthday of Irish Historical Studies. There's the conference very shortly that of Irish historians that they set up. And then you're involved in the Daniel O'Connell celebrations. And it was Dudley, in fact, who really started rehabilitating the reputation of the Liberator, because, well, as you would know, but maybe not everyone would remember now, he had really shrunk from sight because he hadn't turned to violence himself. They were very influential. Before that, historians had worked on their own, so they were all inventing the wheel. They would invent the wheel, and then that version of the wheel would be lost and no progress would be made. After Dudley and Theo set up Irish Historical Studies, all sorts of developments took place. Like, there was a ferocious debate about St. Patrick just in the few years after the establishment of that journal. Had he existed or not? And then eventually it was proved that he did exist. And that's actually very important for a country, because the patron saint carries the values of the country.
Talk to us then about him at UCD, because that's where he became a legend. That's where he became Professor of Modern Irish History, and where he had such an enormous influence over generations of students. Some who went on to careers in history, some who went on to careers in law and becoming Supreme Court judges and so on. And in the book you interview so many people who were shaped by Dudley in some way. But it really was an extraordinary period in UCD where he was at the centre of so much.
Yes, I think he saw history as critical thinking in a way. We tend to think of critical thinking as being developed in maths and physics. But if you're an art student and you really want your mind stretched, that was what Dudley was giving you. And people really enjoyed it and rose to the challenge, because he was, in a sense, he always felt that he was a 17 or 18 year old because of his enthusiasm. I think also because he'd fallen in love with history at the age of 10, it meant that his imagination and empathy was engaged. And so he made the subject not a torture, as it had been in school for many of these people, because they were forced to learn it by heart and never to ask questions. He asked them, he was saying, your opinions are important. You get some evidence and come up with some interesting arguments, and we're going to listen to you. That's exactly what happened, as you say. And he made some amazing innovations, like the taught MA was his innovation. Even the exams he introduced, people loved them. That's actually what Dudley was trying to do, to give people confidence in yourself.
And I know so many historians who worked with him, who were taught by him, who were hugely inspired by him. But whenever I heard the stories about him, I always felt that I wasn't sure if I would have got on well with him because he seemed to take a liking to some people and then champion them. But then others, he seemed to, you know, it didn't work out. And he was a much more difficult figure then, I think.
Yeah. And in fact, oddly enough, I found it quite difficult to get on with him when I was younger because I'd been brought up in England and I'd studied some history, but it was completely the opposite of Irish history. I mean, it was the history where we were taught what an admirable person, excuse me, for this Oliver Cromwell was. So I knew to be pretty quiet about various ideas like that when I came over here. So my relationship with him was difficult, I mean, at first, until we got through that. But I'd say he... if you had an enthusiasm for history and you could back up your argument and you were willing to stand up to him, that really carried a lot of weight with him. He didn't want you to say yes.
He loved public engagement, and there was a TV show that I remember colleagues of mine in Trinity talking about with huge reverence and affection. It was called The Professors, and Dudley was one of the professors, and they would, I think, go to the Shelburne for a dinner beforehand. It was done in black tie, and then they would go out to the RTE studios, and then they would talk about history on TV, and it was a hugely watched program. And one of my colleagues in history said that, you know, you would go into the pub and people would turn it on and you'd be watching it. And it really seems quite extraordinary, you know, very much of its time in the black tie and so on, but really bringing history to a mass audience.
Yeah, that Dudley believed that everyone could be interested in history. And that was one side of what he was doing. In the early 1950s, he launched this campaign to introduce local history across the whole of Ireland, and now every square metre is covered by a local history society. So he did it on the TV, and he did it by going out and speaking to these local history groups and encouraging them. But I think the success of the Professors programme was quite amazing because they almost didn't realise that the television cameras were running on them, and they would carry the debate on as they left the studio.
And he was also very well connected politically in terms of his relationship with Eamon de Valera, with Gareth Fitzgerald, who he knew very well, and he was able to cross the political divide with some deftness and skill.
Oh yeah, no one knows how Dudley voted for most of his life, and I would imagine that he voted for different parties as it went along, because his ideas were just too subtle to be trammelled into one party or not. Even though we're related to the Lenehans, and they thought that Dudley voted Fianna Fáil. I'm sorry if they're listening, because I don't think he would have done the whole time. He was very good at that. He was actually, because He would do things. He would go out and get drunk and climb up trees and do strange things like that. So people could think he was a bull in a china shop. But actually, he was very deft in many other ways, and he could handle those difficult relationships. They were difficult. He found it difficult to get on with Eamon de Valera, but they were great allies, and that they overlapped really on in their absolute passion for education. And de Valera used to talk to him about teaching his children mathematics when he was in prison.
You mentioned Desmond Williams there being on The Professors, and it's an interesting element in the book, those numbers of historians who were involved in intelligence work during the Second World War and who went on then to become historians.
Yes, that's right. You see it in this country, and you see it in England too, and probably elsewhere. I mean, I was really astonished, but three of the Cambridge Five who spied for Moscow were historians as well. And I think the overlap is that there's an ability to try to understand the full picture just from fragments, and to understand issues that aren't often really discussed, like bias in people or communication networks. And in fact, Dudley decided to write about Daniel O'Connell because it was suggested to him by Dan Bryan, who'd been the head of military intelligence G2 during the Second World War, because those intelligence people are very interested in how ideas can develop. And Dan Bryan suggested that O'Connell's neglected reputation should be examined again by a historian, and Dudley took it on really to further the cause of democracy against violence.
One of the great stories about Dudley is the way he initially failed or didn't want to pass Conor Cruise O'Brien's PhD thesis. So Conor Cruise O'Brien had worked, I think, with, was it Theo Moody on what became the book Parnell and His Party, and Dudley was the external examiner. And even though the book perhaps now is seen as a classic, I think Dudley wasn't impressed with the, I suppose, the new approach, the new methodology, the use of political science elements in it, and he wasn't convinced.
Yeah, that's right. Dudley thought that Conor Caruso Byron was using journalistic methods, really, and that what he was writing on a particularly critical part of that book would have been okay as a newspaper article, but didn't have enough evidence to back it up. And Dudley was a bit insistent on that. It looks to me as if Dudley actually was really playing a straight bat there, and you can see his seven-page examiner's report, and it doesn't look... I don't know why Conor Caruso Byron didn't do a little bit more, actually, to satisfy the questions that Dudley was asking, but that actually led to the break with Dudley's relationship with Theo Moody, which was a terrible shame. They'd achieved so much in 20 years, but they were very different characters, really, so... It was a bit like a difficult marriage, and in the end there was a divorce. But actually Dudley stayed friendly with Conor Caruso Byron, because Dudley didn't blame people either in his private life or really in his history. And he thought Conor Caruso Byron had made an error there, but he thought that he was a very good writer and particularly good on the literary side. He regarded him as a literary person rather than a historian.
And it's interesting the way two of his children went on to become historians, Ruth Dudley Edwards, Owen Dudley Edwards. You've a granddaughter writing a history book. It was something that then inspired the next generations as well.
Yeah, the whole house was full of this, you know, from as soon as people got up, you could be having conversations about appointments of bishops in Tuam. To the extent I can't function, for instance, myself in the morning until I've chewed through a few ideas I haven't discovered before. And so there was this absolute thirst there. But then it was focused on history. He had three children, including my mother, who was a history teacher in London for a while. And they all studied with him at UCD. I think it was too much, really, in a way. That was one reason why I myself read literature rather than history, because I just thought, however good I am at history, and I didn't think I was going to be particularly good at it, but that I was just setting myself up to fail. I mean, supposing what one of us turned out to be particularly good, were we just going to embarrass the other relatives by being very good? Or if we turned out to be disastrous, would we embarrass them because we were so useless? So I was really glad to study literature. And Dudley was actually very interested in Brendan Behan, Spencer, Shakespeare, how history was portrayed by them. I mean, obviously, Brendan Behan was writing plays about the time that he was writing in, but it's become his history now. And he'd carried this journey from violence to putting down his arms. And Dudley was really admired that approach, and admired the way Brendan Behan could catch the attention of people. And I think probably Dudley looked at how Behan would get young people interested and would try to copy that a bit in making his lectures as fascinating as possible.
Why are there so few biographies of Irish historians? Because it's certainly big in the UK. The leading historians of the time, AJP Taylor and Trevor Roper and so on, there's been biographies about them. It's big in the United States. It's big in Europe. But yet in our country, despite the records existing for people like Dudley Edwards, yours is really one of the first.
Yeah, that's right. I think people assume that... that it could be a bit dull. They don't realise how fascinating it could be. I discussed this with a friend of mine, Michael Smith. He was the one who wrote about Tom Crean, discovered how interesting Tom Crean was. And I remember Michael Smith saying to me, how are you going to make this interesting? Man sits down at desk, delivers lectures, retires. Whereas actually, if you see the power that historians have, and this is in the book, it's the historians that frame the political narrative, and then the politicians pick it up from them. It's the historians who decide, am I going to write true objective history, or will I do the other side of it? We're going back to the intelligence services here. Will I do the dark side, which is propaganda?
I think what's so brilliant about your book is that even though you are Dudley's granddaughter, you treat this as a proper history where you are engaging with the evidence as it exists. You are prepared to be critical. It isn't a love letter to your grandfather. It's actually an objective study based on the evidence, based on these personal interviews and accounts, where it's looking at the good and the bad of Dudley. It's looking at his achievements where things didn't quite work out. It's looking at the compromises. It's looking at the difficulties and the challenges, and also that remarkable legacy. So you're not afraid of the evidence, and you follow it wherever it leads you.
Yes, that's right. I think that is partly due to my career. I've had to write some very difficult stories. And when you have to criticise someone very hard or ask someone the same question 8 times, did you actually do that? It can stay with you a long time. It's quite painful to do. You make yourself unpopular. I was used to it. And I knew that. I think I probably had it a bit in the blood from Dudley himself. He wouldn't have seen any value in a book that just covered up any of the difficult parts. And the difficult part, in a way, that they are part of our legacy too, because it's called Telling the Truth is Dangerous. Dudley decided to have a very difficult life by, for instance, the story I was just saying about St. Patrick, about questioning did St. Patrick ever live, and that was going to make him very unpopular with the church and with the state. Also his views on the famine. He edited the great book that came out on the famine, which wasn't blaming the British. That would have been the easy way to go. So I had to follow in that path myself. I think he shifted a lot. He didn't necessarily want to be a teacher. He wasn't a natural teacher. He was a student who was encouraging other students to be enthusiastic.
Well, it's a superb book that really captures all those different sides of Dudley, Robert Dudley Edwards. The book is called Telling the Truth is Dangerous: How Robert Dudley Edwards Changed Irish History Forever, published in paperback by Tartaruga Books. The author, Nessa McAlane. And Nessa, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you about Dudley.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. In an unrepentant and revealing memoir, Dan Mulvihill, a leading figure in Irish republicanism, recounts his fight for an Irish republic over several decades and his central involvement in key events throughout the 20th century. And a new book brings this largely forgotten figure in Irish history back to life. The book is called One Man's Ireland, Memoirs of Dan Mulvihill, Maverick Republican. It's published in paperback by Merrion Press. The author and editor is Owen O'Shea. And Owen, you're very welcome back to the show.
Hi, Patrick. Good to speak to you. Thank you.
Well, can you tell us about Dan Mulvihill? Because he was at the heart of so many of these crucial events during the revolutionary period. He was a friend and comrade of Éamon de Valera. He was involved in the Civil War. And yet he's largely a forgotten figure.
He is. I certainly wouldn't describe him as a household name, and I certainly wouldn't describe him as one of the better known figures of the revolutionary period in Ireland. But I suppose the reason he is so important is that he was involved in so many of the very important and seminal events of the revolutionary period and in the years thereafter. And he was a very committed, lifelong Republican. And thankfully, which is how the book came about, documented his life story and wrote his life story shortly before he died. So apart from being such an important figure in Irish republicanism, the very fact that we have a first-hand account of his life story and what he was involved in, I suppose, brings makes him a much more important figure, given that first-hand accounts of that nature from the period are relatively rare.
And he was continuing to write this story in the late 1970s and the early 1980s, so as the Troubles were going on, and he reflects on that in the memoir.
He does. It seems that towards the end of his life, Mulvihill died in 85, but he began work on his memoir, which runs to about 20,000 words, and which he wrote and typed himself on a typewriter over a number of years. It seems that he was prompted to finally put pen to paper, so to speak, by the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And in the memoir and in the book, he seems to have been particularly distressed and disturbed by events in Northern Ireland. And he writes in some detail about how distressed and troubled he was that the Irish government, the Dublin government, was not doing enough in his mind and in his view to come to the aid of the Catholic community in Northern Ireland. So I get a sense that Mulvihill, as an old IRA veteran, if I could call him that, and somebody who had been involved in the War of Independence and the Civil War, felt a sense of betrayal and great distress, as I say, about the turn of events in the north of Ireland, and saw a sort of, I suppose, a continuum between what had happened in the 1920s and what was then happening in the 60s and 70s in the north of Ireland. And I think that was the final prompt to encourage him to document his own life story, and not just his own life story, but his very considerable opinions on matters back then and what was unfolding in the 70s and into the 80s in Northern Ireland.
He tried to get his memoir published in his lifetime and failed. So why wasn't he able to get a publisher, and why has it taken so long to bring it to public light?
Well, he completed the manuscript, according to his own account, in the mid-70s, and he did endeavour to have it. I mean, he wrote it with the intention of publishing it, and he did circulate a couple of copies to contemporaries. He sent a copy of it to Con Casey, who was a fellow veteran of the War of Independence from Kerry, and who had been editor of the Kerryman newspaper for a period, and who had been involved in publishing accounts of that period. But I suspect that because of the time at which he was trying to publish this manuscript or this book, the early to mid-70s, given the events in Northern Ireland that I just spoke about, I suspect that there might have been a reluctance or a reticence on the part of any sort of a publisher or any publication at that time to carry the material, because Mulvihill was so vehemently critical, I suppose, of the turn of events in Northern Ireland, and that's disappointing, I suppose, in that you know, back then, you know, an account of the period that he lived through would have been as valuable as it is today. So for many years, Mulvihill passed away in 1985, having failed to fulfil that ambition, but he did do a brief recorded interview a short time before his death in 1984 with a local man, David Ray, and his son Stephen Ray, who whose grandfather had been a contemporary of Mulvihill's in the old IRA. And in it he described how he had endeavoured and tried to publish this account. So when I came across that recording a number of years ago, I was struck not only by how important the manuscript was, but I was struck how Mulvihill, you know, his wish hadn't been fulfilled. And the more I read his manuscript and the more detail it provided and how informative it became about not just the War of Independence period, but the decades after, I felt very strongly that this needed to be put into the public domain. And so many decades later, Mulvihill's story is finally being told.
And we do get crucial new insights into that revolutionary period from 1916 on and the role that he played, his relationship with Eamon de Valera, some of the crucial events. And we had you on previously talking about some of the ambushes that he was involved in, that he played an important role, and we get new insights into what was happening at this time.
We do. I mean, I'm always struck in these stories and in these situations by how ordinary men and women, and most of them are just very ordinary men and women, became motivated to take up the gun and become involved in the armed struggle against the British Empire in those days. And Mulvihill was an ordinary guy who grew up on a farm in near Castlemaine in County Kerry. He seems to have been sort of first politically motivated by the events of the Easter Rising, and particularly the execution of the 1916 leaders. But very quickly, he rises through the ranks of the volunteers and becomes, you know, a senior figure within his local brigade of the IRA during the War of Independence. And he's one of the leaders, for example, is one of the leaders of a number of ambushes at the likes of Lisbole in West Kerry or Ballymacandy, which I've written and spoken to you about before. But he also comes to the attention of Liam Lynch, who was the chief of staff of the IRA, and Lynch attends a meeting of the local IRA brigades at Mulvihill's home near Castlemaine. Interestingly, in the period after the end of the War of Independence, he takes up another significant role as liaison officer for Kerry during the truce period. And in fact, I think that's one of the important aspects of this book, is that Mulvihill thankfully retained or held on to his papers from this period. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that it's one of the few, if not the only, detailed accounts of the role of the liaison officer during the truce period, which involved, as listeners may be aware, liaising with the army and the RIC to ensure that the terms of the truce were maintained. And Mulvihill writes in his account and writes in his papers, which are held in the archives of UCD, about how difficult it was to keep the peace, if you like, while the Anglo-Irish Treaty was being negotiated in London. But he goes on then to be appointed as an aide-de-camp to Liam Lynch during the Civil War, because Mulvihill was very, very hostile to the treaty. And even though he was concerned about the Civil War and to some extent, I think, saw the futility perhaps of maybe the Civil War and the need for it at all, he does align himself very clearly with Lynch and with the anti-treaty side, and essentially becomes very close to Lynch in those subsequent in the early period of the Civil War before he's imprisoned. So you know, there is a very, from his youth, there is a very continued trajectory of involvement and increasing involvement in that revolutionary period, which he documents in great detail.
He also had a very interesting role during the Second World War as a spy.
He did, and I think that's a very interesting aspect of Mulvihill's life, in that he seems to have remained involved to some extent in the IRA in the 20s and 30s, and he was, for example, briefly involved in a group called Fair Era, which was a socialist, a left-leaning breakaway group from the IRA. But by the outbreak of the Second World War, he was, I think, you know, convinced that if he continued to be involved in the IRA, he'd probably end up in jail at some stage. And he was clever enough, I think, or shrewd enough to abide that by becoming involved in the Irish armies and the Irish government's attempt to, I suppose, keep a close eye on those who were aligned either to Britain or to Nazi Germany during the Second World War. And he became involved in a clandestine and secretive group called the Supplementary Intelligence Service, which was essentially a spy network that was devised or was put together to spy on and collect information on civilians suspected of either supporting or aligning themselves with the British war effort, or Germans who were living in Ireland and in the case of Mulvihill in County Kerry, who were suspected of maybe being sympathetic to or perhaps assisting the German war effort. And there are, he details this in his memoir, and there are some of his original reports to army headquarters in the National Library, in which Mulvihill describes, you know, various characters and individuals living in County Kerry who were considered to be aligned to one side of the war or the other, during which, of course, Ireland remained neutral. So he clearly had good intelligence gathering skills, which had been developed during the War of Independence and were put to good use by Emmett Dalton, who he was reporting to in Army headquarters. So it's interesting that he was shrewd enough, as I said, to sort of take up that role, rather than, I suspect by that point, Mulvihill had realised that the days in the IRA were at an end, and that you know, the Free State did exist and had existed and was there to last. So he was clever enough and politically shrewd enough, I think, to take up that position. But it does give us some very interesting insights, I think, as well, to the intelligence gathering of that period during the Second World War and the paranoia that existed about what was happening.
And how did he feel about the new Irish state and how it developed? Because you do get a sense that he was frustrated with certain things. He was frustrated with how veterans were treated. He was frustrated with how things developed in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, he was. I suppose another significant phase of Mulvihill's life, which he documents in his memoir and which are detailed in the accounts held in the military archives. In later life, he very much became an advocate for old IRA veterans and indeed the veterans of Cumann na Mban. He was very annoyed and angered at the high rate of refusals for pensions among IRA and Cumann na Mban veterans. And as we know, the vast majority of pension applications were refused because the threshold was set quite high. So he began to provide references and supporting letters, really, for those who were applying for pensions. He began to lobby government ministers, and not just Fianna Fáil ministers, but government ministers of all parties, what he considered the paucity of what was being made available to the men and women who had taken up the gun and who had fought for Irish independence between 1916 and 1923. And there are some quite, you know, angry exchanges with ministers over the years and with local Fianna Fáil TDs, who he essentially accuses of abandoning the old IRA. He also writes to fellow veterans of the period, people like Moss Tunian and Dan Breen, and I suppose tries to advocate for those who had been involved in that period. And he also contacts other, you know, some of his peers from the period, encouraging the old IRA to do something or say something at least about what was happening in Northern Ireland. And even though obviously many of these men were in older age at this time, he felt that you know, more should have been done or could have been done to come to the aid of the Catholic and Nationalist community in Northern Ireland. So he's very much right up until the end of his life, really. He might have put down the gun, but he certainly took up the typewriter when it came to his activities. And he both advocates for pension applicants and advocates for, I suppose, a political voice, or at least that the old IRA and the veterans of that period would mobilise and say something and call for action from the Irish government in terms of what was happening in Northern Ireland. So you have that sort of, I suppose, continuum through his life of republicanism and the republican spirit that he very much advocated. And that's why I think that account of somebody like that who continued to be active, so to speak, in politics and in a revolutionary life, as he saw it, is so valuable and so important as we, you know, as we continue to add to the story of the whole revolutionary period.
And it certainly does add considerably to our understanding of that period. The book is called One Man's Ireland, Memoirs of Dan Mulvihill, Maverick Republican. It's published in paperback by Merrion Press. The author is Eoin O'Shea. And Eoin, keep up the great work.
Many thanks, Patrick. Good to talk to you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back to Talking History. Limerick, for some, the home of Irish rugby. For example, Limerick man Charles Barrington is credited with formalising the game as we know it in Ireland. Since then, Limerick has contributed some of her finest to the ranks of legends of the Irish game. Likewise, you can't write the history of the British and Irish lines without Limerick. Names such as Keith Wood, Paul O'Connell, Conor Murray, David Wallace and Keith Earls. And a new book tells the story of the Limerick Lines. It's called Limerick Lines, Limerick and the British and Irish Lines, 1888 to 1988. It's published in paperback by TTT Press. The authors are Des Ryan and Stephen Roshitsko. And I'm delighted to welcome one of the authors, Des Ryan, to the show tonight. Des, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Patrick. Nice to be here.
It's an incredible story, Limerick and rugby, going all the way back to Charles Barrington and formalising the game and writing down these sets of rules in 1868 in Trinity, and then a very distinguished history since then.
Yeah, Limerick has had a long, and I guess very proud, connection with rugby in Ireland. Charles Barrington, obviously, was the source of it, but there have been lots of others. And the other thing about Limerick rugby is it's considered to be, I guess, less of an elitist sport in Limerick, and there's reasons behind that if you delve into the history.
So let's talk about this book then on the Limerick Lines. And you chose 9 to include, and I suppose the century year span, you know, helped define things in a certain way. But given that there are so many crucial names and so many big names, how did you decide who to include and, more importantly, who to leave out?
Yeah, well, when we first started researching this, we first had to say, well, what defines a Limerick man? Is it being born in Limerick or is it playing for a Limerick club? And there are so many big names that are so deeply rooted in Limerick rugby that we took a kind of a broad approach to it. And so using a broad approach, there are 23 Limerick men or adopted Limerick men who have played for the Lions. The newer ones, you know, the names you've mentioned there, you know, Conor Murray, Paul O'Connell, etc. Everybody knows them. They've all written their own stories. They've written autobiographies. But the further back you go, the names become a little bit more obscure and people don't know about them. And that's why we decided to go early. And 100 years was a nice round number. It's almost up to when the game became professional. And it just happened to be that there were 9 players in that that timing.
And some of these lines had really careers full of drama. What story surprised you the most in your research?
Every single one of the guys we looked at, all 9 of them, had some kind of a strange story. You know, the very first guy, a guy called William Roach, you know, he was a boxing champion as well as a rugby champion. But he had an encounter with Rudolf Hess during World War II. That's one example. Tom Reed is another one where he went on tour with the Barbarians in 1959 and took the "what goes on tour stays on tour" mantra a little bit too seriously and never came home from Canada. You know, the others, you know, Mick English commandeered a ministerial car to get home from the 1959 Lions tour. And Ginger McLaughlin, or Jerry McLaughlin, has probably got the broadest story in that he was obviously very famous for his rugby, playing for Munster in 1978 when they beat the All Blacks, playing for Ireland, scoring an amazing try at Twickenham. But he went on, obviously, to be the mayor of Limerick. And rugby wasn't always easy for him. He suffered greatly because of the Irish tour to South Africa in 1981. It had a real impact on his life. And he had another major incident when he was playing down in Argentina, where he was held at gunpoint. So he had some interesting stories. So no matter where we looked, there was something interesting to write about.
Talk to us about Colm Tucker, because Colm will be familiar to people who might remember his own career, but also his son, Connacht head coach, his daughter, Rachel, also an international rugby player. But Colm had the distinction of playing more times for the Lions than he did for Ireland.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. You know, in Limerick, there's a lot of people who would consider that there is politics involved, or that there was politics involved in getting selected for the Irish team. Some Limerick players moved to play for Dublin clubs to try and advance their careers. Colm Tucker didn't. So he was the Shannon player. And if you're gauging rugby success on club career, he's up there with the very best. He won the Munster Senior Cup 5 times in a 10-year period. He was instrumental in bringing Shannon to the final on 9 occasions. He went on to be a Munster selector. Again, he was on the Munster team in 1978 that beat the All Blacks. But for some reason, he never cracked the Irish team. And he was actually selected for the Lions before he was selected for Ireland. And getting selected for Ireland, a lot of people felt it was because he had done so well with Munster in 1978, and because the Lions had identified him, that they picked him. He ended up playing 4 times for Ireland, but he played 9 times for the Lions on the 1980 tour to South Africa.
So, Des, maybe let's talk about Tony Ward then, because he had not only a remarkable career with the Lions, and again, I think 5 appearances in South Africa in 83. I think he had that test cap beating the All Blacks against Australia as well. But he also had a soccer career, and he played with Limerick United, won the FAI Cup, played against such giants of the game as Kevin Keegan, Glenn Hoddle and Ozzie Ardiles.
Yeah, Tony Ward is an amazing, amazing athlete. And we were very lucky to have his support when we were researching the book. So his background, obviously, he was born in Dublin and potentially a contentious inclusion in the book as a Limerick man. But when we spoke to him, he proudly showed us a certificate that hangs on his wall at home saying that he was an honorary Limerick man. He came to Limerick to study in 1975, I think. And before he came down to Limerick, he'd actually played for Shamrock Rovers. So he had two seasons with Shamrock Rovers. He played for them, I think, 35, 36 times. And when he moved to Limerick for university, he, for a short time, continued to commute to Shamrock Rovers games. But ultimately, the commuting was too difficult and he had to focus on his studies. And he focused on playing rugby here with Gary Owen. Limerick United had a bit of a golden spell in the early 80s. There was they won the FAI Cup, and Tony was part of the team that won the Cup. And having won the Cup, then they qualified to play in the UEFA Cup the following year against Southampton in the first round. And so Tony played home and away in the game against Southampton. Kevin Keegan was on that Southampton team. Unfortunately, Limerick United lost over the two legs. In advance of that game, a great Spurs team came to Limerick to play a kind of a warm-up game, I guess, to familiarise the team with playing international or playing international teams. And on the Spurs team that came to Limerick that Tony played against had the likes of Ozzy Ardiles, who won the World Cup just a few years earlier, and Glenn Hoddle, very famous, obviously. Spurs won that game at Thomond Park 6-0 with Glenn Hoddle scoring three goals. And you'll find that there's a lot of Spurs fans around Limerick because of that game. People who attended that game, I guess, fell in love with Spurs and are still supporting them now. But yeah, Tony, amazing all-around sportsman.
Let's go back to the Lions tours, because in those days, it seemed to be very different in terms of the length of the tour, the amateur spirit. It seems very different from today's professional rugby scene.
Yeah, definitely. So for the Lions, obviously, date right back to 1888 when the first tour took place. That was really just a bunch of English players going on a bit of a jolly to New Zealand and Australia. They played 35 games on that tour. When you compare that to the current tour, which is, I think, 9 games. For the first two tours, there was no Irishman involved. It was only on the third tour to South Africa in 1896 that Irish men were invited. And on that tour in 1896, Tom Crean captained the Lions, and Tom is also famous for having won a Victoria Cross in the Boer War. But in those days, there was no flying. The first Lions team to fly was the 1955 team, I think, was the first to fly. So before that, there would have been a dozen odd tours where they went by ship, and to sail down to New Zealand or Australia was a 6-week journey in those days. These were amateur players. They had to get excuses to not be at work for 6 months at a time. They would, practice their scrums on board, on the deck of the ship on the way down. And even if it was a South African tour, it was still a 2-week journey. The other thing that those long trips enabled was for the Lions to play in some obscure places. So over the years, everybody would think of the Lions as playing in South Africa, New Zealand or Australia. But they've played in Fiji, they've played in Canada, they've played in Sri Lanka. And most of those were on the way to or from one of the big destinations.
Do you think the working class roots from Limerick help shape the style of play and the personalities that emerged?
Yes, absolutely. There's no question about that in my mind. The first 9 players that we studied in this book, 7 of them were forwards and 2 of them were out halves. And so there's definitely a Limerick forward aspect to the rugby. We can date that back to, there's a guy called William Lamb Stokes, who was very instrumental in rugby in the late 1880s in Limerick. And he set up a junior league in Limerick to try and broaden the number of players. And so when the junior league was set up, he ensured that the games were played on a Sunday. And because the games were played on a Sunday, it meant that the working man was able to play. If it was played on a Saturday, you know, they would all have been working. And as a result, you had these, you know, big, strong, manual labouring men who played rugby in Limerick. And it certainly influenced the style of play that Limerick has always been famous for. And it's always made Limerick rugby different as a result.
What do you hope younger readers will take away from these stories, especially given that it is, as we say, quite different in the professional modern era?
My hope is that people will start to look at some of the names here and recognise them. I think one of the things that, you know, everybody will remember, as I said, the current players, everyone knows them, they know them intimately. But, you know, kids out there don't know who Tom Clifford was. And Tom Clifford was an incredible athlete. You know, there's the Young Munster Ground is named after him. You know, he played 20 times for the Lions, including 5 tests, which is up there with the very, very best. So what we're trying to do is to try and resurface some of these amazing athletes and men who played for the Lions that are starting to drift from public consciousness.
And if you had to pick one of your 9 Limerick Lions as the ultimate symbol of Limerick rugby, who would it be?
Ooh, that's a difficult one. So I guess I'm a little bit biased. My father's first cousin is Tom Reid, who's in the book. Tom is an incredible character. But if I was picking one, I'd probably go with Bill Mulcahy. You know, Bill was 2 tours. So he played on 2 different tours. He was the first Limerick man to go on a second tour. He captained the Lions, an incredible man, and, you know, deeply, deeply involved in rugby throughout his life. He passed away just as the book was starting to be put together, and his family were very supportive in helping us put it together. But he had a great, you know, great history, great story, some famous games like the Battle of Ponchestrum he played in. And one of the things we uncovered about Bill during the research was when the GAA Rule 27 was finally abolished in 1971, 2 weeks after that game, Bill Mulcahy put together a team of rugby players, took on a team of Gaelic football players led by Kevin Heffernan. And so they played each other and the game ended in a draw. But, you know, lots of great stories about all of these guys. But yeah, I'd pick Bill if I was picking one.
And then finally, why is Limerick for some the home of Irish rugby? Why is it such an iconic place and so intimately connected with the story of Irish rugby? What made Limerick this home for rugby?
Well, I think if you go back to the fact that it was played by the working man, it meant that everybody had buy-in. It wasn't an elitist sport here. You know, players played for their local team, their local parish. And there was great pride associated with that. You know, we spoke to Ginger McLaughlin, and, you know, he listed off of all of the great things that he'd done in his career, and I asked him what his favourite thing was, and he said, "I just wanted to beat Gary Owen while playing for Shannon." So there was a local passion that drove Limerick for a long time. It's probably faded a little bit in the last 10 years because of the success of the hurling team, but Limerick rugby has always been special, and hopefully it will continue to be.
Well, it's a brilliant new book. It's called Limerick Lines, Limerick and the British and Irish Lines, 1888 to 1988. It's written by Des Ryan and Stephen Roshitsko. It's published in paperback by TTT Press. And I'm delighted, Des, you're able to join us tonight.
Thank you.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. And my special thanks to my producer, Mairéis O'Sullivan. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.